I count it an honor and a privilege to be with you this morning and have a chance to share with you a part of what I have tried to learn regarding this text. I grew up in the Middle East and was privileged to teach New Testament for 10 years in Egypt and 20 years in Lebanon and 10 years in Jerusalem. My area of specialty is trying to understand the New Testament in the light of the culture of the Middle East. The two stories that we have before us today are stories that happened in Jericho. For some very strange reason that I cannot understand, the Byzantine monks in the 4th century put them into separate chapters. I'm quite sure that they are meant to be read together because the first is Jesus dealing with the oppressed and the second is Jesus dealing with the oppressor. They are a pair. The book of Ecclesiastes in chapter 4, verse 1 reads, "I saw all the oppressions that are practiced under the sun, and behold the tears of the oppressed, and there was no one to comfort them. And on the side of their oppressors there was power, and there was no one to comfort them." An amazing text. We see this text fulfilled in the stories before us. The first story begins with Jesus approaching Jericho. It is Passover time, and he is on his way to Jerusalem, and we're told in the text that there is a great crowd. It is easy for us to imagine that a great crowd has followed him from Nazareth from the north. Probably that may be partly true, but Middle Eastern traditional custom requires that when a famous person comes to town, it is expected that the leaders of the community should go out some distance, greet the guest, and escort the guest back into town. When my family and I were living in the south of Egypt, when the late President Nasser was president of Egypt and he came to visit Asyut, and some 8,000 to 10,000 people walked about 8 miles outside of town, stopped the president's entourage, obliged everybody to turn off the motors in their cars. They attached ropes onto the front of the cars and dragged the cars the last 8 miles into Asyut to be sure the big man knew he was welcome, and I presume he got the message. On a very simple village level, I have had this experience myself of the elders coming out to greet me and escort me into the town. It has happens also in the great city of Aleppo, or now over 1 million people in northern Syria. When the patriarch comes to town, the leading citizens in the Christian community drive their cars to an open lot at the edge of town towards Damascus. They wait for the patriarch to come. He comes, he gets out of his car, greets everybody, and then there's a parade of cars back into the town. This is what is happening to Jesus. Jesus is a messianic pretender. By this time, he is a national figure. He is so well known that when he gets to Jerusalem, Herod Antipas wants to see him and asks Pilate to send him across town because he wants to eyeball it with the famous man. Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem at Passover. Having lived in Israel, Palestine for 10 years, I know what Passover means. For us, Passover and Yom Kippur are put together. For the Jewish community, Passover is the time in which they remember their political liberation from Egypt, and Yom Kippur in the fall is when they remember and recollect their sins. So the mood of Passover is, whoopee, we got out of Egypt, yay! This is Passover. Fine, the messianic pretender is on his way to Jerusalem to celebrate Passover, and so the leading citizens of town want to have a discussion that will go late into the night and into the early hours of the morning as to what his plans are. Is he going to start the revolution? The Messiah, of course, is going to drive out all of the foreign oppressors, and Passover, the time in which we remember our political liberation from Egypt, is a good time to do this. The blind man asks, what's going on? They tell him, Jesus of Nazareth. He cries out, have mercy on me. And the crowd says, shut up and sit down. He doesn't have time for people like you. The man cries out all the more, and Jesus does not go to the side of the road to talk to him. He tells the crowd that has just marginalized this man and treated him badly to become the courtiers to escort him to the presence of the big man. It's a very nice touch. He then gives the blind man an exam. What can I do for you? Now, look, he's blind. Come on, give me a break. Aha. But you see, begging in our Middle Eastern traditional society is a recognized profession. And the beggar offers services to the community. Everybody is supposed to be pious, so you're supposed to give alms to the poor. And if the poor aren't out there, you cannot fulfill your duty before God. And so the beggar doesn't say, hey, bud, you got a buck for a cup of coffee. He says, I'atilillah, give to God. I have nothing to do with it. I'm giving you an opportunity to fulfill your duty before God. And he always sits in a public place so that you'll get, you know, as much publicity for your benefit. Everybody's going to see you as a pious man fulfilling your duty before God. And if you give him something, he will stand up and in a loud voice, he will ask for God's blessing on you and on your family and your going out and your coming in and your investments and your portfolio and goodness knows what. And also praise you as the most generous human being he's ever met in his life. Now, you may not be the kind of person about whom such very nice things are being said in a loud voice in a public place. It does give you kind of a boost for the day, and it ought to be worth at least a dollar. Aha. But to do this, you have to have something wrong with you. Now, I in no way mean to demean the suffering of those who are in the beggar's class, but I do notice that they are generally on the stout side. They manage. One leg, no, probably won't make it. One arm, a sore back like mine, won't do. But if you are blind, guaranteed lifetime income. If Jesus heals this man, what is he going to do tomorrow? No one will give him anything. His profession will be stripped away from him. He has no education, no job training, no CV, no skills. He cannot do anything. He never has done anything in his life. One of my former students became a missionary in Bangladesh, occasionally found a beggar beside the road who perhaps had fallen into the fire as a child, lots of scar tissue, couldn't walk, could be healed by very careful surgery, and my friend offered to pay for the surgery, get the man to the hospital so that he could be whole again, and he never had anybody willing to accept. They all refused. This is their profession. The point is that grace is free, but when we accept the free grace of God, we take upon ourselves fresh responsibilities. It's not cheap. Jesus is saying to this man, even as he said to the man beside the pool of Siloam for 38 years, do you want to be healed? The man says, yes. He passes the exam. I want to see again. Some medieval Arabic versions translate this, and taftah anayya fa absarak. I want to see that I might be able to see you. A nice little Christological flourish. It's not in the text. I love it anyway, and I think it's presupposed. He does want to see Jesus. Please notice that the crowd has been given a very sharp slap over the wrist. The person you told to shut up and sit down, Jesus has chosen for special grace. They absorb the criticism, and they go on praising God and proceed to the place where the banquet for the evening has been prepared. No, Jesus goes right on through town and starts to go on his way up to Jerusalem. Whoops, no banquet. While I was at the Ecumenical Institute in Jerusalem, we were privileged to have ex-President Carter and his wife, Rosalind, as our guests for an afternoon. We were told there wasn't time for a meal, but we could have tea. So our dining room was about the half the size of your sanctuary, and all the tables were taken out except just one U-shaped set of tables, all the chairs taken out, and everybody who knew how to spent the week cooking all kinds of goodies, and the tables were overloaded with good stuff to eat, such as you can't imagine. And the meetings ran late, and the Carters walked through the dining room, and Rosalind was kind enough to pick up one cup of tea and take one sip, and off they went to the next meeting. And there was no joy in Mudville that day. What are we going to do with this mountain of cookies good enough to feed an army? That's what happens in Jericho. Aha, there's a man there who wants to see him very badly. His name is Zacchaeus. He is not only a tax collector, he is a chief tax collector. The Romans used a system that's called tax farming. They sold the right to collect taxes by auction to a local person and told that local person how much money they wanted at the end of the year and didn't ask any sticky questions about how much money that person raised. It was a system that was guaranteed to have built-in abuse of power and graft. The tax collector was hated because the money goes off to Rome. It doesn't build streets in the country. He is seen as the traitor of the community. And this man has gotten rich in this process by draining the economic lifeblood out of his own people. I discovered what is involved with this when we lived on the West Bank, and with the first thing we noticed about the Palestinian collaborators with the military occupiers of the West Bank was that collaborators were always very careful about their back, and the one thing they never did was mix in crowds, especially if they were short. Because if you dare go into that crowd, what is going to happen to you? The quick flash of the knife, the stifled cry, nobody finds the body until the crowd is gone. What did they do with collaborators in South Africa? They put rubber tires over them and burned them to death with gasoline. What did they do to them in Paris? They put them in jail or they shot them. The Palestinians started killing some of their collaborators. There was an outcry in Israel, and Israel Shahak, a survivor of the Warsaw Ghetto, on public television, said, "Don't you say a word to these people." I, he said about himself, was a youngster, I was a teenager in the Warsaw Ghetto, and our people caught collaborators with the Nazis, killed them with butcher knives, and we danced dances of joy around the bleeding bodies in the streets. I understand all of this. I condemn none of it. I condemn it all, but I understand it, but I do not condone it. This man is the town collaborator. He dare not push his way through that crowd. So what does he do? He runs down a back street. No one will see him. Running is a very humiliating posture for people in power in the Middle East. And he goes out of town. We know that because he climbs up into a sycamore fig tree, which for reasons of ceremonial purification, was the rabbis said, cannot be grown in the town. It has to be some distance away. It was grown because it had large limbs that went out this way, and they were split for the beams of the roofs of houses. And it is a tree that has big leaves. That's why we're told what kind of a tree it is. Olive trees have a leaf about this size. You can see right through the tree. Pine trees, we know what they're like, and you can see through them also. But the sycamore fig has a big leaf, and you can climb into it easily, and once in it, you can hide. He wants to hide. Why? Well, how many times do important, powerful people in your community climb trees at the 4th of July parade? His Honor the Mayor, does he climb a tree to watch the parade? How about the president of your college? No, I don't think he climbs a tree at the parade either. What about the chief of police? Is he going to get caught up a tree at a public parade? No. This man does not want to be seen. He hopes the crowd will be gone because they will have left town and that no one will notice that he's up there. The crowd is not gone, and they do spot him. We're very sure of that because Jesus can see him and calls his name, and if Jesus can see him, so can the crowd. So what do you think that the crowd has to say about good old Mr. Zach now that the polecat is treed? And all the juicy things that you wanted to say in his office all these years and couldn't because he has a position of power, you can now hide behind the head of the person in front of you, and you can call out any four-letter word you choose. And one cat call triggers another, and pretty soon there is a whiff of violence in the air. Alan Bosak in South Africa at one point was preaching. This was before the fall of apartheid, and a collaborator was spotted in the congregation. And finally, Bosak had to quit preaching, go down into the congregation, get the man on his shoulders, carry him out and down the street and put him in a taxi to save his life. With the whiff of violence in the air, Jesus is obliged to respond, and he is expected to say, "Zacchaeus, the hostility of this crowd is fully justified. You have betrayed your nation, your God, your people. You are draining the economic lifeblood out of them and giving it to their oppressors, and you're lucky that they have not hung you in the tree in which you're trying to hide. What is required of you is to quit your job, pay back to these people the money that you have stolen from them unjustly, go to Jerusalem and go through the ceremonial process of purification, come back and see that your defiled house is purified, get a job that is within the observance of the law, and start living the life as a law-abiding Jew. If you do this, the next time I come to town, I will drop in for a congratulatory cup of tea." Audience reaction. That isn't what happens. Jesus says, "Zacchaeus, I didn't think I had time to talk to anybody in your town. I have just changed my mind. I accept your gracious guest to be your invitation to be your guest for the night." Oh. So he doesn't have time for us. He's got time for the town collaborator. And he's on his way to Jerusalem to celebrate our political liberation from foreign oppression. And there's plenty of time for us to get word to Jerusalem about this political indiscretion. And once he gets there, the big boys will know how to take care of him. Did you notice that the anger against Zacchaeus is now shifted to Jesus? They're no longer mad at Zacchaeus. They're now mad at Jesus. "By his stripes, we are healed." Zacchaeus accepts to be found. And this is Jesus' definition of repentance. Jesus takes the traditional hostility against the tax collector, which he must have shared because he grew up in that culture, and has transformed it into grace. And he offers to Zacchaeus a costly demonstration of unexpected love. It is costly, and it is a demonstration, because the deepest things must be acted and not spoken. It is unexpected because Zacchaeus didn't earn it, and its nature is love. And Jesus is acting out one of the deepest levels of the meaning of his own cross. And everybody, Zacchaeus looks down at Jesus and says, "He's getting hurt for me. This is round one. They will be back with a bigger stick." He takes Jesus to his house. They have a meal with Zacchaeus' defiled friends. And they are reclining in a triclinium. And in the middle of the banquet, Zacchaeus feels the pressure to respond. Nobody tells him what he has to do. But he stands up and pledges to clean up his financial act, which means he reacts out of the deepest level of who he is, not the deepest level of who someone else is. And Jesus has the final word at the end, and he says, "Salvation has come," passive, "to this house." How did it come? It was brought. By whom? By Jesus. How? At great cost. since he also is a son of Abraham. Like Abraham, he's starting out in a journey, not knowing where he is going. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. To seek means Christmas. To save means Easter. To seek means incarnation. To save means atonement. And the Good Shepherd has found one more lost sheep. May he also find us. Amen.